Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello. Welcome to another episode of Ancient Office Hours by the Ozymandias Project. Trireme Transit is now boarding for all new and returning passengers. Now departing, present ponderings. Next stop is Ancient Office Hours at a library lost in the sands of time.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 67 of Ancient Office Hours. This week, I chatted with Dr. Matthew Roller, a professor of classics at Johns Hopkins University. His research and teaching range widely over the history, literature, philosophy, and art of ancient Rome. His current large-scale project investigates aristocratic competition in the early Roman Empire, particularly in the realm of oratory and eloquence. He has authored three books: Constructing Autocracy, Aristocrats and Emperors in Julio-Claudian Rome, Dining Posture in Ancient Rome, Bodies, Values, and Status, and Models from the Past in Roman Culture, A World of Exempla. He has also written numerous articles, chapters, and shorter studies. In 2023, he is serving as president of the Society for Classical Studies, the National Professional Association for Classicists. In this episode, we chatted about how a slow culture shift in acceptance for double majoring in STEM and humanities, how to define monumentality, cultural memory, and their relationship to each other, and dove into the practice of gift-giving in ancient times and the various meanings behind them. I hope you enjoy this episode, and if you like what you hear, please give us a 5-star rating and review us on Apple or Spotify. You can also subscribe to our Patreon, as this will allow us to reach more people and make more exciting ancient world content. Enjoy!
Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon, and I just wanted to start you off with what I hope will be a very nice, easy question to ease into things, which is, how did you get into classics and ancient history? Where does this love start for you?
Well, I remember that when I was in fifth grade, I had to do a report on the Greek alphabet. And I remember making up a big poster board with pictures of all those funny looking letters. And that didn't go anywhere in particular then, but for some reason that sticks with me. At the time I had to do the report on the Greek alphabet when I was 10. But I think the real story, I went off to college being very much in the 1980s, being very much a natural sciences, engineering, STEM kind of focused person. But at a certain point, took an elective course. I'd taken a, back in those days in the 1980s, many universities had, a required freshman kind of core curriculum that typically in those days was called something like Western Civilization, right? So I did one of those and was in a section with a classics professor, and he was very interested in Plato and Aristotle, and we had a lot of discussion about classical Greek philosophy. And that caused me, the next year when I had a humanities elective that I needed to take, I signed up for a Greek history course because I'd gotten interested in the department. And then once I did that, I realized I had an opportunity to start ancient Greek language. And having just done a semester or a quarter, actually, in that institution of ancient Greek history, I suddenly felt that it was, I felt a very strong urge to start the study of the language. And at this point, I was a physics major. And I was doing, you know, at that point, modern physics and starting on quantum mechanics and some of these sort of higher level courses in the undergraduate physics curriculum. But there's actually it's not just about the draw. It's also about maybe you could say the repulsion created by other options. So I remember having a real struggle with quantum mechanics when I was a junior, which is a very counterintuitive field. You feel like Newtonian mechanics is about the world of throwing balls and sliding things down ramps and planets orbiting, and it's intuitive. The world of quantum physics is very much not intuitive, and I was very much struggling with some material. I went to office hours, to my professor's office hours, and at a certain point, he looked me in the eye and he said, "If you need to be taught at this level, you will never be a physicist." And, you know, one question you could ask is, what's the job of a professor? But I didn't think to ask that. I thought, oh my God, I'm just not good enough to be a physicist. But meanwhile, I was really enjoying studying ancient Greek. And so I thought, well, I changed directions and I decided to double down kind of late in my career. I was able to piece together enough credits to be a classics major instead of a physics major. And I began studying Latin also, because that's what one did. That's just how the discipline was put together. So I did Greek and Latin, and then went off to a PhD program. I've really enjoyed it. I took to it, and I felt a real enthusiasm for it, and I had no regrets. But there's one more footnote. When I was in graduate school, I had a roommate for a couple of years who was a PhD student in physics. And I told him the story I just told you about my professor of quantum mechanics. And this roommate of mine, who was himself completing a PhD in physics, he howled with laughter. And he said, "Nobody ever understands quantum mechanics when they're undergraduates. When you're a PhD student, you come around and you do quantum mechanics again, and you still don't understand it." So that was so his view was that I had given up without good cause. Anyway, so that was my path untaken. The physics major I never completed because I couldn't really handle quantum mechanics as a junior. So that there was that repulsion that went along with the attraction of wanting to dig deeper into the kind of fascination I had with, at that point, ancient Greek society and Greek thought and literature.
I'm like both so impressed. I'm so impressed that you even had the makings of a potential physicist. I mean, it's so cool. That's one of the more unique stories that I've heard. And it's actually, yeah. I mean, if you don't feel bad that you kind of turned around and then just sort of reoriented everything, then I don't think anyone should feel bad. But at the same time, it's like, oh, you could have at least maybe been a double major and then been like doubly as awesome, because then you can say, yes, I have, you know, I'm physicist and a classicist. You know, that's a cool double combination. But I guess like, it's interesting that you ended up going into the more Roman side of things, because I would have thought maybe potentially because of your interest in science, you would have gone into like studying Archimedes and become like an expert on Archimedes or something. So, you know, because you didn't take that path, which I think people would have been like, oh, well, that would have made sense. Like, how did you then go about finding your specialty? And did you have a moment where you were like, oh, I could study like ancient science? Or was that just like long gone, the boat has sailed, didn't want to do that?
There's about five things I want to say to what you just said. The first is just that back in the 1980s, it wasn't that common for people to do double majors. I knew people who were pursuing double majors as undergraduates in that era, but they were somewhat unusual. And it's a very different world now. Most of the students around me here at Johns Hopkins, it feels like most of them have double majors, but I think what's really going on is that a large number of humanities majors also have a STEM major. So the culture has shifted, but the institutions have also shifted to make that more accommodatable in different kinds of ways. And I think that's a great thing. I look at these students, because there are students who are classics and physics majors, and I think, you know, a generation later, I would have had a somewhat different experience, I think. As for studying ancient science, ancient technology, I thought about that. I thought, I wonder if I have a special, you know, kind of potentiality to do that kind of work. I think that what happened there was when I went off to do PhD work, I went off with the view, not that I had my own agenda, but that I was still very new to this field and I needed to learn the field. And so I was willing to kind of sit back and let other people drive the bus, and I was riding on the bus. So I took the seminars that were offered, and I did the exams that were required, and so on and so forth. And the PhD program I was in did not really have on the faculty a specialist in ancient science or technology. It just wasn't part of the faculty at the University of California at Berkeley back in those days. And so I didn't really have a chance to engage with that work at the graduate level. But I found the other work that was available and the other projects that were opened up to me to be very engaging. And my fellow students were wonderfully engaged and enthusiastic people. And I'm still close to a certain number of my graduate student cohorts. So that leads me to just another point. It's fun to be a classicist precisely because you can be a dilettante. We define the field so that really everything from the Bronze Age down to about the 6th century CE, if it's in the Mediterranean basin writ large, which goes all the way over to Mesopotamia and all the way up to Scotland, right? And all the way to the sources of the Nile, the Mediterranean basin writ large, anything that happens in that time period in that region is fair game. So if you like ancient literature, it's yours. You like ancient philosophy, it's yours. You like art, you like archaeology, it's yours. Ancient technology, great. Language, linguistics, whatever. You can do anything you want, and it all counts as classics. And had I gone into a more modern field, I would have had to be one of those things, right? But as long as it's in the ancient world, I can skip around. And I've done that. I've, you know, produced scholarship and taught on ancient literary texts and poetry and prose and historiography and epic. And I've studied Pompeian wall paintings and sculpture and thought a lot about that and gone into storerooms of museums and taken lots of photographs. And I've gotten deep into some strands of ancient philosophy. And right now I'm going down a number of rabbit holes relating to Roman law, which is an area, it's a huge area that I've really known very little about. So, you know, I've been around here for a while, but there's always something new. There's always some new thing I can do because it's classics. So that's my story about why I like classics. You can be a dilettante and it's okay. In fact, people even think that's a good thing.
Well, no wonder I fit in then when I declared classics as my major freshman year. I was like, well, I will just be a dilettante in my own corner then. And it's great.
I'm sorry. I had one thing I didn't say. You asked me how I wound up doing more Roman style work with the origins kind of in an interest in Greek. And again, this was a footnote to the point I made about my going to graduate school and deciding to sit back and let other people drive the bus for me. When I was a graduate student at Berkeley, the rule was that new students had to pursue a master's degree in the language or literature in which they were weaker in order to bring it up to speed, and then they would enter the PhD program. So having come in with a lot more Greek than Latin, I began by doing a Latin master's degree. And it turned out that doing doctoral level work in that material, the doctoral level work itself was so exciting and engaging that it just swept me away and I never looked back. And that happened to a lot of people at Berkeley. They would come in and start doing their master's degree, part of their program, in their weaker culture, and then that would take over and they'd wind up, it was not uncommon for people to wind up really in a very different place from what they came in intending to do, just because of this funny little rule that the program had.
Wow, that's fascinating. Do you know if they still have that rule?
I don't. I'd have to go dig around on their website and see how the program is set up. Most doctoral programs in classics are kind of they're a single kind of homogenized process where there's a 5 or 6 year progression and you do this and this and this. And there isn't even a master's degree. It's just you go straight to a PhD. There might be a moment where you're given a master's degree as a courtesy. But at least in those days at that institution, there was a formal master's degree you had to complete. And it was assumed that you would be successful and would then proceed to the doctoral program. But they reserved the right to throw you out after the master's degree if they didn't think that you were performing well. I don't think I ever saw that happen to anyone, but it was a kind of a quasi-serious step. They had built the master's degree into the program as a kind of a checkpoint. And that meant that I could go through commencement and I got to wear one of those master's robes with the really long floppy sleeves. And that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed my master's commencement, and I remember it more than I remember my doctoral commencement.
Interesting. I want to go and I want to look up that program. I mean, I just graduated with a master's like a week ago. And the thing is, because I did mine abroad, I did mine in Greece, it was sad. They didn't make a big deal out of it. So our ceremony, there's no caps and gowns. And then you just show up in whatever, you look nice. And then it was a bit sad. I was like, oh, I don't even get to be the little master's hood or anything. No. They just, it's very simple. It was very fast. I remember sitting there being like, oh, this is going to be like a somewhat longer commencement, right? No, it was like half hour tops. And so our like keynote commencement speaker was a professor, and she spoke for like 10 minutes and we were like, oh, that's it. Okay. So yeah, then they just called our names and then our degrees were handed to us on a normal piece of paper. And it was very ceremoniously unceremonious and unpretentious. And then that was it. And they were like, okay, so you're graduated. Congratulations. Let's go out and get some pictures and then you're done.
European universities don't really do commencement the way American universities do. And people imagine that the way we do it is because it's the way the Europeans do it, right? But we completely made it up. It's all fabricated. It's all a bunch of neo-monastic nonsense. I mean, there were never scholarly monks who paraded around. Anyway, Europeans don't have time for that. And most students don't even go to their commencement. They're done.
Yeah, it's true. And I was so shocked by it. But you know what? It was a good wake-up call. Although I think from what my friend said, there's a bit more sort of ceremony for bachelor's. And then for PhD, there actually is a more. But yeah, they said at the master's level, they were like, no, they really just don't care. They're like, here you go. Like, have fun. And, you know, as someone who I was like, well, I don't know if I'm going to really get a PhD, maybe in the future. I'd like to, but I haven't found anything I'm like passionate enough about to spin into a PhD dissertation yet. So it might be a few more years. But I said, you know, if this is it for my education, if this is all I'm going to get, it was like happy, but also a little sad that it didn't have much ceremony. So I'm like, I'm kind of tempted to do another master's just so I can get an actual nice graduation, but that's kind of stupid. I shouldn't do that.
Hey, that's a little extreme to subject yourself to 2 more years of master's level work just so that you can go through the commencement.
I know. I was like, oh, I think that's one of those things where they would clearly log it under the, this is a really terrible idea for like 2 second payoff. Are you sure you want to do that? And then the answer for most normal people is, no, you're right. I don't think I'll go through all of that work and the stress and then having to write a whole nother thesis. Yeah, that would be a lot just to, you know, get 5 seconds of fame walking across the stage in a robe.
Do I get to ask what your thesis project was?
Sure, sure. So I did my thesis on, well, the program I went to is actually a modern political science program. So my degree is in Southeast European studies. It's a specialization on the history, politics, and economics of the Balkans and Greece. And so I took an amazing class on contemporary Turkey. And I'd always had an interest in nationalism issues and cultural heritage. So I went to my advisor and I somehow spun it into writing about nationalist cultural heritage policy in comparing the Atatürk period with the Erdogan period using Hagia Sophia as my case study. And I wanted to talk about the religious iconographic changes on the building and how it was a symbol of Atatürk. And so somehow he was like, sure, sure, I'll let you write that. And I was like, this is the most like broad, I was shocked that he let me do it, because I was like, I don't actually know how I'm going to weave in all of these elements, because I started writing and it seemed like it was something for a classics degree. And I was like, well, I can't have it all historical. What do I do? So I brought in modern cultural heritage issues, and he somehow was like, we'll take it.
Well, it's certainly a live topic. I mean, it's been within the last, to my knowledge, just within the last couple of years that Erdogan has started to be talking about, you know, whether he will sort of allow Christian rituals to still be carried out in that space. Of course, it's not really a church. Maybe part of it is still a church. Of course, it's a mosque. I can't remember. But he is still based in Istanbul, right? Well, I don't know where the patriarch does his stuff in Istanbul. I shouldn't say anything because I don't know. You probably know.
It's funny. I avoided a lot of the Greek Orthodox stuff, and I actually only talked about like Islam and how Islamic like iconoclasm affects monuments and cultural heritage. So it was very centered on that. And it was funny because I never thought I would really go back to iconoclasm, but my last year as an undergrad, I took a class on Byzantine art, and it instantly became one of my favorite classes because we covered iconoclasm. And then I got super in the weeds and then went down all these rabbit holes and was like, this is the coolest thing to study. And so it was funny, during my Turkey class, I kept repeatedly bringing up and tying things I was learning in with that concept. And my professor, I remember he was just like, why are you using an ancient art historical concept in my class? He's like, this is modern politics. And I was like, because it's connected. It's inherently connected. Exactly. It works. And so he was like, okay, well, prove it to me. So I would have to read and come back to him and make my case. And so I think that was partly why he probably said, fine, you can write your thesis on this. Because I think he was even curious at the end about how I was seeing the connections. So I want to thank him all the time for letting me do this, because I realized it was super ambitious. And my thesis, unfortunately, was so short that I definitely know I didn't have enough time to delve into everything with, you know, the depth that I wanted to. But I got enough that it ended up being a decent thesis, I hope.
It's fine for an MA, and that's where you are, so.
Exactly. Although it was really flattering to hear him say I had enough material gathered that I could have turned it into a dissertation, into something longer. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I have more there for the future, but I'm not sure I would want to do that, because when you're playing with modern Turkey, I was kind of like, I asked him several times whether he thought I could get banned from going to Turkey for writing these things in my thesis. And he said, well, the good news is you will not probably get banned from Turkey because not enough important people will read your thesis. And I said, you know what? It's fine. I'm fine with that.
Well, thank you for the description. Sorry to sidetrack you, but I'm I often find other people's work and projects far more interesting than my own, in large part because they're new to me, right?
Yeah, well, no, you know what? I can, luckily, getting on the topic of my thesis is actually the perfect segue you've provided me, because what is Hagia Sophia other than it's a giant Christian and Islamic monument, and it lives very deeply in the memory of both the Greeks and the Ottomans, the Turks. And I know a lot of your work is done on, I mean, now granted, much more ancient, but the relationship between both of those things, monumentality and memory. So I'm just going to segue that right into, I did a sort of modern version. So can you talk about the more ancient version that you've been working on? I mean, is that the concept of monumentality as a whole? Are you looking at specific things? And what do you mean by memories? Is it the memory, the cultural memories of people? Or, yeah, how do you define that?
These are all complicated terms and concepts. The whole topic of monumentality and memory is one that's been around for a good long time. I'm in no way, shape, or form an inventor of the core concept. I think many people, when they begin talking about this topic, they go back to a kind of a classic study by a French sociologist called Pierre Nora, a project that he carried out in the 70s and 80s and wrote up in a big four-volume set. But it was about what he called places of memory, lieux de mémoire, that had to do with the construction of the identity of modern France. And whether you care about the identity of modern France or not, the kind of riveting part is the notion that there are places where memory, and what that means we have to think about, gets sedimented into the place or into the buildings or into the land that is there, and it becomes a place that is meaningful for people in terms of thinking about their social and cultural attachments, their identity, if you will. So that's kind of one of the foundational studies that I think launched across a lot of disciplines, not just in classics, an interest in thinking about how understandings of the past, how people understand the relation between their own world and the past. And that past may be not the real past. It may be a past that's been constructed for their consumption, or they may construct it for their own consumption. But it's about understanding how people relate their present circumstances to some putative past, and what the medium is by which that understanding is communicated. Maybe the first thing I'd say is an obvious kind of monument, and this is monument writ very large, would be a historical narrative, right? Somebody writes a history book. And from my point of view, I would say a text that describes past actions is a kind of monument. In Latin, monumentum, the word underlying monument, monumentum is something that reminds you. It's from the verb moneo, to warn or remind. So a monumentum is something that warns or reminds you. And obviously, if you take that very largely, then a text is such an object. But you can also imagine how buildings or anecdotes that people tell, or marks on your body, or configurations of the landscape. There's a million things that could be taken to be some kind of transmitter of information about the past to the present in ways that help people to understand or cause people to believe something about how they relate about how they relate to the society they're in and how their social group is created and sustained. So I use the example of a historical narrative, but it's full of stories about, you know, things that were done in the past, and they're selected by someone to create a certain kind of image. And if you read that, then you have perhaps a story that makes you think, ah, I am this kind of person, and these people are my community or my kin, and we share this thing, and our forebears shared that thing. And so that monumentum, the text, becomes a way of relating your identity construction in the present to events or practices or people in the past. So that's a kind of a quick response. When we talk about memory, we're not talking here about individual memories like, I remember when I was six, or I remember when I was 10, I did a report on the Greek language, on the Greek alphabet. These are what are sometimes called cultural memories, which are basically stories or understandings that are passed down across spans of time greater than one person's lifetime. Okay, so they go beyond the possibility of living memory and into the realm of transmitted stories or information that have to be mediated, right? Because if you don't remember it in your own head, somebody has to tell you, or they tell you that their grandparents told them, or somebody wrote it down and you read it, or somebody built something and you can go look at it and say, ah, that building was built then for this purpose. So once you get to the point where that information about the past is being mediated through, basically it has to get outside one person's brain, then we're in the world of monuments. But it's a very different kind of memory. See, it's not what I remember. It's information about the past that is kind of being passed along across generations. And then you have to worry about how that information changes over time. Just, you know, witness, as always, kinds of endless disputes about how we teach American history, right? Is it a narrative of an ever improving society and an ever greater kind of a rising arc sort of story, or is it a story where we stress our failings and our perpetual blind spots? How much do we lean on slavery? Do we tell a story where slavery ends with the Civil War and we're good after that? Or that, you know, racism ends with the civil rights era and we're good after that? Or do we tell a story where these are episodes in a perpetual struggle? And these are hugely contested, but all of this is about monuments and memory, really. It's about how we understand ourselves as a community based on the stories we tell about ourselves in the past and our understandings of where we came from and how we got here.
That's so fascinating. I mean, it's so fascinating. I mean, and as you were talking, especially about the memory thing, because I'm very curious about cultural memory and collective memory stuff, not enough to be able to, you know, I'm no expert, so I can't really do a deep analysis of those things. But what it sounds to me like is it's really like the exciting study of something starts, something historical, something narrative, and then it basically makes its way down through the giant, like it's like a giant game of telephone, right? Like, okay, it's retold. What are people saying? Yeah, it's like, what are people saying? And does it get to, you know, the modern community? And then does it sound this like similar, or is it completely different? And on the one hand, I suppose looking at the Greek side of that, isn't that basically what Homer's work is? We're not even sure who this person was. Was it one person? Was it many people? And then working with ancient cultures like ancient Greece and Rome, where a lot of the history was oral. And so most of these things, they're sung, they're told, they're not written down. So have they definitely have changed in the years, but we don't know how much. So that's what it sounds like to me. But I like the telephone analogy. That's my favorite.
There's one maybe small nuance I'd make about the telephone analogy, which I think is good, but you sometimes get a monument that was erected for some reason, and in later years, it's forgotten what it meant or why it was erected, and other stories get spun up to try to make sense of it. And so even the monument itself is not locked in time. What it's made to mean is constantly changing. So just a very trivial example, on my own campus here at Johns Hopkins, there is a kind of a modernist sculpture that was erected probably in the 1960s that is, it's very abstract. But it's a sort of an aspirational thing that has kind of pointy things that sweep up. But there's no caption on it. It's just there. I came to learn eventually, and one can find out, that there's a particular sculptor who sculpted it, and the piece is called Dove. And if you look at it and kind of squint from a distance, it does, you know, vaguely resemble a very kind of abstract, very large dove. But it has two big pieces that are locked together. And the story that gets told here, you know, the campus tours on all campuses, there are people who kind of walk around backwards and they lead people on tours. You know, the high school juniors come with their parents to tour the campus. And the story that gets told about this sculpture is that it is it's a combination of a giant comma and a giant wrench, and they're fitted together, and they represent the humanities, the comma, and the sciences or engineering, the wrench, and they're put together and they're fit together, and it's a visual metaphor of the mission of the university and the ideal of bringing together what we might call technical or scientific work with humanistic learning. And this is the meaning that is given to this, right? So the sculpture meant one thing, but the people looking at it have decided that it means something else. And they have an explanation for why it means. So that would be an example this is one where we can at least recover the original meaning, but you know, you can imagine one where the object is such that you can't recover the original meaning. And then it just becomes a Rorschach test, and every generation can decide for itself what the thing means. And so you can keep reconfiguring your understanding of the past. You can make the past into what it needs to be to authorize the community you want now. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it's super interesting. And I do love how you gave me a more contemporary example as well. Because I think when you started to talk, I immediately, my mind just jumped to sort of, okay, ancient monuments that I suppose, you know, they had their intended purpose, and that in the modern era, some people, I can't mention who because I don't actually know who believes this truly, but... You know, my mind jumped to something like the pyramids, because we have evidence and then it's a nice big tomb. And then we have people out here saying it's a giant grain silo, and then they choose to believe that. And then, you know, we might have a future generation of people who believe it was basically a big storage room. I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but that's a interesting deviation that I suppose telephone pulled its way out there.
Yeah, the older things are, the more I think they can function that way. You're probably familiar there. There's, to go back to an ancient monument, there's a very famous statue of the Emperor Marcus Aurelius on a horse. And it's a bronze statue, and it's gilded, and it sat on the Campidoglio, the kind of main hill in the middle of the big piazza there that Michelangelo designed. And it sat there for a very long time. And it's since been moved indoors, and a replica has been set up, which is good. But it's very rare for such a big piece of work to survive from antiquity. And as far as we know, it's always been above the ground. But the secret was the early Christians thought that it represented the Emperor Constantine. So they left it intact. They didn't melt it down or break it up. So from their point of view, there's an emperor on a horse, and the only emperor who matters is Constantine, therefore it's Constantine, right? So that's a much more constrained example. They weren't too far off, but they were just far enough off that it made a real difference for the monument, but it also made a difference in how they understood themselves as a community. They thought that at that point, someone was, you know, already commemorating that emperor in this way, and that became an important moment and point of authorization for themselves as a new community, as a new religious community. And they were totally wrong, but it didn't matter, right? Who's going to tell them they're wrong? There's nobody around who's going to say, no, sorry, that's actually Marcus Aurelius. You're 2 centuries too late, right?
Well, I mean, how fortuitous for the monument, its physical survival then. What a happy error that was. So, the other thing that I saw, I forgot where I read it, but I read it somewhere. But I saw that you were interested in the idea of reciprocity and social exchange in ancient Roman times. And those are two very modern concepts that have a very modern meaning. And I think I speak for a lot of people when we say, well, is the meaning the same in ancient times, or does that look completely different from sort of the image that would pop up in my head if you were to just tell me those words now?
Yeah, there's always this issue of the language we use to talk about things in the present in our own language and the terms that are available in the target culture that we're talking about, in this case, an ancient culture. But certainly, an abstract noun like exchange or reciprocity, those are actually both perfectly good Latinate words. They're English words that are spun up off of Latin stems, but they're not Latin words. You'll never find, you'll never look in a dictionary and find the Latin noun reciprocitas. It won't be there, right? This is a bit of a shorthand. When we say reciprocity and exchange in certain kinds of academic circles, it makes our audience or some people in our audience think of a certain body of theory, of a certain set of scholars and a certain sort of set of approaches to analyzing societies that actually has its roots in anthropology in the late 19th to mid 20th century. And there was a time when it was common for ethnologists to kind of go off and live among the people in the culture that was being studied and try to understand how the society worked. And famous examples of this were an anthropologist in the early to mid 20th century called Malinowski, who did big studies of societies in the Southern Pacific, the island societies, and how they traded. And he got very interested in the protocols of visiting, because it took some doing to visit another island. You had to get your boats together, and they were very long journeys sometimes. And you brought lots of gifts. And so then you'd give the gifts and you'd receive gifts. Then you'd sail off again. And there would be these great cycles where very slowly over time, these communities would send representatives around among the islands, exchanging various objects, but including particular shells that were considered to be very high prestige, and kings would gift prestigious shells to one another, and some of them were very old. And right, part of their story, like in Homer, is all the people who'd had it before it came to you. But all of that is obviously about building relationships. And it's also about exerting power. right? If you give someone something for which they feel gratitude to you, you have some kind of power over them. But you've also linked yourself. If you give someone a gift, there's going to be some expectation somewhere, maybe down the line, that they have gratitude to you. They'll give you something back. So there's social power relations, and there's also ways of building and creating social connections that are kind of built into this whole apparatus. When I describe it that way, you can then see how it really applies to any society, right? And actually, Malinowski was helpful for thinking about Homer in the middle of the 20th century. There are people who said, you know, gosh, when we hear, you know, that Glaucus and Diomedes exchanged armor, and this armor that Diomedes gave Glaucus, he said, came to him from so-and-so, and it was made by somebody else. And that sounds just like these kinds of exchanges, you know, among leading men in this or that contemporary society. So this is how it begins to apply to ancient societies. I'm willing to bet that there's probably not a society on earth where people don't give gifts and receive gifts and then feel guilty if they can't give back the right sort of thing in the right sort of time frame, or feel embarrassed if someone gave them something that was too much, or feel embarrassed if they gave something that was too little. All those dynamics, I think they're just universal. But they're all ways that we build and maintain and attempt to adjust our relationships to one another. So that was the angle I was taking in studying certain questions in like Roman society, was thinking about descriptions of things being given and received, and descriptions of people saying, I owe. What do you owe? What does it mean to say I owe? There's lots of different theoretical frameworks for like classifying types of exchange. The simplest one that I like is the distinction between, ready for this, what's called commodity exchange, which is basically money, okay? It's price setting. You know, I want this book and you want $24.95, okay? So I give you $24.95 and you give me that book. And it's a price setting regime, commodity exchange. We say this thing is worth the same as that thing. Two objects are defined as having the same worth and you just hand them over, one person to the next, right? You get your $24.95, I get my book. Boom. The alternative is, or the contrasting regime is called gift exchange. And what that means is that the objects aren't equivalent. And they're also not traded at the same time. But I give you a present on your birthday. Okay? You don't pay me for it. You don't give me anything back. I give you a present. Well, I'll have a birthday and maybe you give me a present. Or maybe you have a dinner party and invite me over later, right? But you won't do it tomorrow. It would be really weird if I gave you a birthday present and then you invited me to dinner tomorrow, right? That would be very strange. It's like, what? So with gift exchange, it doesn't happen instantly. There's a lag of time. I give a gift, and if there's a counter gift, it'll happen later, maybe in a different context. It'll be a different kind of object. It may not be a thing. It may be a service, like an invitation to dinner. And in the meantime, you owe me. And we have this kind of relationship because we're bound by that gift and by the tension between the gifting and the... And then when you invite me to dinner, I don't sit there and think, okay, we're done, right? I gave you a gift, you invited me to dinner, we're clear, we're done. No, now I think, oh, what am I going to do for her next time? So you get into this dynamic of back and forth, and it creates this relationship. So gift exchange, your objects aren't commensurable, and they happen at different times. Different kinds of objects move at different times, and they bind the people together. Commodity exchange, the objects are commensurable. They're worth the same. The book is $24.95. $24.95 is the book. you and I have no relationship. I give you the money, you give me the book, we're done, right? I don't have to invite the salesperson to dinner. We're just done, right? So these are the two regimes. Commodity exchange makes the objects the same. Transaction happens all at once, but the transactors remain independent. Gift exchange, the transactors are dependent on one another. The object are not commensurable, and they move in different ways at different times. That was a little chaotic, but that's just an example of the way people think about different ways exchange works to create relationships or not create relationships.
I mean, it's fascinating, and it got me thinking, okay, where have I seen something like this portrayed in the ancient world? And it was really funny because my brain just jumped to, have you seen the HBO Rome series?
I've seen snippets. I'm embarrassed to say I did not sit down and like really watch the thing. I'm not actually such a good person on popular culture and classics. It's a weakness in my configuration, I'm afraid.
It's really long, and it is one of those beautiful series where it's dirty and gritty and violent, and a lot of people just don't want to sit through that. So I know plenty of classicists who have not watched Rome or anything else, just because these things do tend to be portraying slavery and rape and some of these horrible things that were very common in the ancient world, and they just choose not to. So
that's what we need to watch, though. That's the thing. One thing that's great about modern reconstructions is to try to, we're always all trying to fill out all the gaps, right? That's what we're doing. We've got snippets and we're trying to fill in gaps. We're all doing that. That's what scholarship is about, filling in the gaps. If somebody's making a movie, they have to fill in all the gaps, right? You can't just like leave a gray spot because you don't know what it looked like, right? People would say, what's that weird gray spot hovering around? It's like, oh, well, we just didn't know what that thing looked like, so we didn't portray it. You can't get away with that, right? You have to make something that looks believable. So I'm actually a huge believer in historical reconstructions, even if they're fantastic, they're really interesting.
So when you were describing the idea of exchange, I was thinking, well, there is, it may have been one of the clips you've seen from Rome. There was a scene where some of the main characters, the family of Octavian, basically Attia and her daughter Julia, there's a scene of them discussing what gift to send her great rival Civilia, who is basically at that point, I believe she's still Caesar's lover. I want to say maybe I don't remember the timeline of the show. It's a bit muddled, but I remember they have this shocking scene where she says, ah, I know exactly what I'm going to give my great rival. We're going to send her a slave because we feel bad. We're going to send her a slave carrying like a giant, and I think in the show it was like a giant egg of gold, kind of like the eggs you would see for like the novelty Easter bunny eggs, you know, just like a big wrapped egg of gold. So it was like a solid gold egg, and then you have this like naked slave coming in. She's like, oh, she'll love these are perfect. And she says, yes, go to and be the gift, be sent. And he leaves. And then it's great. I think a few scenes later, you see the slave arrive, and then you see Civilia say, ah, yes, okay, who's this from now? Oh, Attia the Julia. Oh, okay, great. I don't need you, go away, or something like that. And so that's what my brain jumped to when you're talking about, because it's one of those instances portrayed in the TV show, at least, where she's trying to give her rival a gift, but not because she actually wants to build a friendship. It's like a don't hate me, I'm sorry / whatever gift. Yeah, I think it was like, or maybe it was something about like her affair with Caesar had been found out at Attia's instigation. She felt bad. She was like, well, haha, I wanted to make her forget this little brain fart, so here's a gift. Yeah, so just even the use of gifts in that sense is very interesting.
Well, it raises an interesting question, because gifts can certainly be weaponized, right? There are gifts that get sent to people who do not want to receive that gift, right? What they really don't want is the relationship it implies with the person who sent it. That's what they don't want. And that might be kind of what's going on here. If it's a very grand gift, they might not want to feel like they're kind of subordinated because they've received something that's, you know, too great for them to really reciprocate. In Roman society, you have these social hierarchies. Sometimes it's described as a society with, there's a concept that a generation ago was very widespread. We hear a little bit less about it now, but people would talk about patronage in Roman society. And if you ask what patronage is, it's very hard to get to pin people down on what exactly is meant. But it's the idea that there are persons of high status and wealth and power, and that they have relationships with people of somewhat lower status and lesser wealth and power, who are kind of they're kind of in the orbit of the great man, and they turn to him for help and they support him, and it's a kind of a cabal. There's not necessarily like blood relationships, and it's not necessarily like master-slave relationships where there's legal ownership, but there's just sort of social relations between people who are technically all independent, but in fact, there's these financial and other sorts of dependencies. But the idea is that those patronal relationships are sustained by exchange, by the exchange of goods and services, where they're all useful to one another. But the main thing is that the rich person, the guy on top, can outgive anybody. He can always give more than could ever be reciprocated by the recipient. And so then the recipient always feels indebted. The recipient is trapped, he's captured, because he can't, it would be impossible to walk away having received that gift. And so then he's kind of trapped into a relationship with this great man, whether he wants it or not. That's now the social reality. So giving is a way of creating social hierarchies that are actually potentially durable and can create these sort of ongoing relationships of subordination. So I think if Servilia, if I were giving a Roman analysis of that scene, I'd say what Servilia does not want is to find herself somehow indebted for a rich gift and somehow obligated or subordinated to Attia. Right. She doesn't want that relationship. So she rejects the gift. Though that's also very
interesting. Yeah, I guess no, because these scenes, you know, they happen a bit quickly, and so I don't know if I'm able to pick up exactly on the nature. I just kind of go, oh, on its surface, okay, she's just rejecting the gift out of spite because, you know, oh, she must hate her, or she just because there are people who definitely reject it because they don't want to feel indebted. And then there was a great, I think it was Anne Boleyn, like famously when Henry VIII was like courting her, he would send her all these jewels and gifts to try to woo her and make her want him. And I remember she was famous for playing the game where she'd be like, she'd tell the maid, you know, who brings in all these beautiful jewels, no, send it back. I am not worthy of this greatness. And of course it makes him crazy. And then he's like, oh no, if jewels don't work, then what do I need to do to court this woman? And of course it's pretty insane. So
I have no idea what the writers had in mind. I doubt that they were thinking about Roman patronal relationships, but that was just what that brought to mind for me is, and it's, but even now, you know, if you reject a gift from someone, it may, you know, we've seen this happen. I don't know. We had a tiny scandal last fall during the race for the governorship of the state of Maryland. And the Republican candidate was filmed at one point chatting with some people who approached him at a rally who turned out to be members of a kind of a far-right Christian nationalist group. And they gave him some little something. I can't remember what. And this created a little kerfuffle during the gubernatorial campaign, because it appeared as if this candidate was receiving a gift from that kind of person. And the candidate then said, no, I didn't. That isn't what happened. But again, the whole question was, did he or did he not receive the gift? Right? Because presumably, if he'd received it, that would appear to say, I want a relationship. I endorse what these people stand for. So anyway, that, it was just a little ruffle, but the imagery of being offered a gift and whether you take it or don't take it can be very resonant now as a way of telegraphing what relationships you are choosing to have. So that would be a very contemporary example, I guess.
Okay. I wish we had longer to go in, because I could probably conjure hundreds more examples, but I know we don't have time for that. So I will restrain myself and say, oh, darn, well, there's a lot more and I need to go watch more things, because now I kind of want to pick out if I can see all the different means of bartering or gift giving or like some of these exchanges, because it's so interesting to me. In the meantime, I need to move forward. So I kind of end the interview portion of the podcast with three final questions. And the first of which is, when you were either an undergrad or a grad student or both, did you attend office hours?
I did on occasion. I believe that I generally went to office hours when I felt that I genuinely was confused or in difficulties, and to see if there was help available. I didn't take advantage of office hours in what I now think is actually a much more important sense, which is simply to build some kind of relationship or some acquaintance with, you know, with a kind of an amazing intellectual resource who is available to you in the university setting. That's what I think the real advantage of office hours is to be able to just go and chat with a faculty member and see what they're thinking about. And what have you paid all that money for, right? To come to this institution, have access to these people. But I did it in a very transactional way. I thought I shouldn't trouble anyone unless I had a concrete question. So that's a yes, but I went, but not for the right reasons.
That's fine. I mean, at least you went. I guess, and you can answer this question from either your perspective as someone who went or as someone who is providing the office hours. Do you have a particular highlight or favorite memory of some conversation or just something that stands out about a really special anything that happened during an office hour?
Well, I told you the story about the professor of quantum mechanics. That happened during an office hour. So that's a real standout. I'm trying to think on a maybe more positive note. I remember one time visiting a professor, a math professor, again, back when I was a science kind of major. I was taking a freshman, some kind of calculus course. And I remember I had a very quirky mathematics professor. And I went to his office hours with a friend one day. We kind of screwed up our courage and we went into office hours. And he was a strange and quirky man in class. But what I discovered in office hours was that being off the stage, where he wasn't having to think about, this was the old days, writing out equations on the board in chalk, right? Because we didn't have PowerPoints back then. He seemed to be much more at ease, and he was quite a bit more accessible. It was easier to ask questions and to have a discussion, just because I think he found it less, right? He wasn't trying to deliver a lecture and trying to keep that in his head and have all those students out there. He was just chatting with a couple people. And so I remember finding that particular office hour visit. I don't remember whether it actually helped me with my question, but I remember being struck at how different my impression of that man was from meeting him in the setting with just one other student in his own office, as opposed to sitting in the classroom with 20 other people, beady eyes pointing at him while he's trying to write stuff on the board. Well, yeah, you get a different kind of persona in the classroom versus in the office hour, I would say.
Definitely would agree. And then you kind of touched on it before, but I'll let you expand if you want to. If not, that's okay as well. But in your capacity as a professor now, if you had to give a 30-second to a minute long elevator pitch to students for why it's important to go to office hours, what would you say?
I try to say in a more coherent and compressed way, more or less what I just said. I think the great thing about visiting a faculty or instructors, whether they're professors or even graduate students in office hours, is just to learn about what makes them tick. Why are they in this community? You're in this community. You have a sense of why you're there. Why are they in this community? What brought them there? And what are they taking away from it? And what are they bringing to it? I think office hours helps you to understand, potentially helps you to understand the university as a community, as an intellectual and social entity, as well as just a kind of a mechanism for delivering, you know, information and technique from people who have it and know the techniques to people who don't have or know them. And then also the second point being that all of these people are quite different in the relatively informal and unprogrammed setting of office hours from how they're going to be appearing in class, where their brains are filled with how am I going to get through my lesson plan for today and get it all up, and how do I manage the clock, and the kind of, oh my God, I'm on and I'm performing. Very different kind of person in that setting from what you'll find if you're just coming in to chat with them.
Couldn't agree more. It's a very special time that not a lot of people, or not enough people, take advantage of. And I went to my favorite professor's office hours because she had a chocolate drawer, so I could just get chocolates. I mean, I loved going to see her anyway because she was like the most wonderful lady, but also chocolates.
I'll tell you one more office hour story that you just reminded me, the drawer of chocolates. There was an art history professor when I was an undergraduate who did ancient Greek art, and she had a small number of ancient Greek vessels, not like fancy red figure pots that ought to be in a museum, but just very coarseware, almost industrial-like cups. But from the 4th century BCE, they were like, you know, kitchenware. And she had them in a drawer. I mean, she bought them somewhere. They didn't cost much. They weren't decorated. They weren't painted. There was no prestige, but they were ancient Greek cups. And she would pull out a bottle of Metaxa, this awful Greek brandy, and she would pour a drop or two of Metaxa in one of those cups and let her students just sip a little bit out of it. I think technically that was probably illegal because most of us only won at that point. But I remember Jody Maxman serving up a few drops of Metaxa in her ancient Greek cups out of the filing cabinet in her office. That was a kind of a special, and I have to say, the fact that it was being drunk out of ancient Greek cups didn't make it taste one iota better.
No, but at least the experience was like, it tasted terrible, but you could say you had it out of an ancient Greek cup. So it was at least a cool experience.
Indeed. And now here I am talking about it as an office hour experience all these years later.
Oh, that's one of the best ones I've heard. That's really unique. I don't like Metaxa, but it would have been cool to drink it out of an ancient drinking vessel, I will admit. But okay, well, at the end of each podcast, I ask if every guest will read a copy of Percy Shelley's wonderful Ozymandias poem. And then after reading it, if you could just give us your quick thoughts on, you know, why do people seem to like this poem? Is there something truly timeless about it? I mean, people speak very highly of it. And I'm always curious about, you know, what is it about this poem that strikes people to their core when they read it?
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
All right, here we go. Ozymandias. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, "Two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk in shattered visage, lies whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things, the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed." And on the pedestal, these words appear: "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair." Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
It's basically my favorite of all time, I think.
It's a great poem for classicists in all kinds of ways. And I'm sure that's why you have classicists read this on your podcast.
Yeah, so if you could just tell us, you know, what does this evoke for you? You know, do you think it's as important as people, you know, people place a lot of value on it and say it's one of the most influential poems? Do you agree with that? You know, does it, you know, why do we think it's so cool, basically?
Yeah. So I'm not enough of an expert or even well enough acquainted with English Romanticism to be able to like speak to the influence of the poem. But one thing that Shelley was obviously very interested in was kind of the aesthetic of the ruin, the aesthetic of the fragment. And that was very characteristic of the Romantic period. The piece of the great whole, all you have is this little piece, and then somehow out of that you have to conjure that whole. There is a way that's what we're all doing in classics. We have these tiny little fragments of texts, of cultural information, and we're always trying to spin that up into a picture of a whole society. But I think there's more to Ozymandias, which is it's not just a fragment, but it's a fragment of a monumental work, right? That is some very ancient person's, you know, assertion of their power and dominance and immortality. And in a weird way, it worked, because here's the traveler who's read it and remembers it, right? So did Ozymandias, maybe Ozymandias gets the last laugh, right? He really did remind people that he existed. But the irony is, you know, see my works, read my works in despair, you know, and it's shattered and lying on the sand, and there's nothing else except those words. So there's nothing to despair about. But I suppose this is very banal, but it really makes you reflect on the ravages of deep time on human creations, right? So we all are very much preoccupied with our own lives and our own projects and day to day, and how did I do on this? And, you know, is this a... I don't know how many of us are preoccupied with our legacy, but many of us in different kinds of ways are, I think. And this is a reminder that, you know, go out a few millennia and really, I mean, really. But I still think maybe Ozymandias gets the last laugh. We're laughing, as it were, at the gigantic arrogance of his claim that is completely negated by the context in which we find it. But yet, you know, he attempted to monumentalize himself. And if that just means, remember my name, remember I existed, hi, guys, you know, basically somebody waving a hand from the deep past and saying, hi, guys. Well, it worked. He waved his little hand. The traveler saw it. The traveler told Shelley, and Shelley told us. So maybe it goes both ways.
This is a completely new take. So I'm hoping that there might be some truth in it then, because I mean, I suppose, yeah, when I normally look at it, you know, I'm like, okay, well, definitely thoughts on monumentality. Shelley was writing this about a giant statue of Ramesses II, which was uncovered and was on its way to be housed in the British Museum in the 1800s when he was writing. And so he was very inspired by this. And so I just, so as readers now, yeah, if we know, oh, okay, well, it's written about a big statue of Ramesses II and his empire is gone, that could mean one thing. But also, you're right. I mean, okay, monumental statues, they get hidden in the sand and they can get lost or broken. But we still find the pieces. We can still reassemble them with modern technology. And so they will be remembered, because now we put them up in museums and we do look at them and we do go, oh, look at this great wonder. It's broken, but it's a great ancient wonder. So there could be a lot of truth in what you had to say.
Ozymandias is nobody, right? But I kind of like to think that he would say, well, darn, I'm sorry my empire fell, but I think it's great that three millennia from now, people still know who I was. That's not so bad.
Exactly. Although, and then there is the political dimension of when Shelley was writing. I mean, the way I normally look at this poem is, you know, oh, this is a memento mori. It's a reminder that we will die, and it's all very political when you look at it that way, I've found. But you know, it's like, oh, okay, it's transient. You know, it's a statement on the ephemeral nature of political power, because this man did think his empire would still be standing, you know, into eternity, and it's clearly not. So you're kind of like, okay, I don't know what you're thinking, whether it was like, my empire will be there, so they'll know me, or my empire could fall and they'll still know me. We have no idea, which makes it super, super fascinating. But because of the political implications of it, the last question I ask all my guests to think about, and it's one of my favorite questions because the answers are always so different, is, if we consider the poem from the slightly more political side of when he was writing and this nature of power and lasting monumentality, if you think about our contemporary society right now, do we have like a modern equivalent of Ozymandias, like something that we think is so great and amazing? And then realistically, future humans, will they look at that thing and say, yeah, we're right, it's amazing? Or will they look back and say, oh, y'all were crazy. Like, this is so stupid and ridiculous. Why did you think that was amazing?
Yeah, that's funny. You have to be a futurist to try to guess what might, you know, what might, you know, in say thousands of years, assuming there's still people around on a planet that's inhabitable and all those sorts of things, right? You know, what would they make of this particular age? I think from a large enough distance, the book, just the creation of the codex style book, still looks like a pretty world beating technology. It was a good one, and it's still going strong. It's not an invention of our age, but I was thinking just more broadly about the impact humans have had on the Earth. In this era, you know, in the last 200 years, the human population on Earth has gone from probably under a billion to aiming up toward 8.5 to 9 billion before it peaks. And just the amount of human construction, human forming of the Earth and of Earth materials into forms that humans use. So Ozymandias, you know, carved stone, that's an example of that. But I'm thinking of, you know, the millions of you know, residential skyscrapers in the giant Chinese and Indian cities and Western cities. You know, what will be the fate of all that material? Will we disassemble it and build, you know, more modern buildings in due course of a different sort? Will we have a catastrophe and they'll, you know, with great abandonment and destruction, and maybe eventually they all just fall down and go into a layer? And, you know, and the sands blow in, and archaeologists of the future, you know, excavate Shanghai and they find that stratigraphy. I mean, just imagine what that layer will look like, that destruction layer. Let's go out 50 million years, right? By the time it's actually a, you know, geological line in the geology of the Earth. And just think of the weird chemical signatures, right? All of our iPhones with their strange rare earth elements, they're going to be like, how did like all of these weird elements appear all over the world in this little layer? What happened? Maybe a meteor impact. No, I suspect they'd still be able to tell that it was the activity of some sort of society. But I guess where I was going with that is the idea that what a future age might find amazing is just the magnitude of the production of material at this moment of peak human population, because we're going to come down off this peak at some point, and I hope we hit a nice glide path and that we don't come down off it like, you know, by way of a famine or nuclear war that kills billions of people. But sooner or later, we're going to hit peak population. It's going to start declining. And I wonder what the future world will think of the infrastructure we built to sustain the population of the size we have now.
Yeah, very, very interesting thoughts. I mean, it's not an easy question, nor is it meant to be, because there's so many different ways, different ideas that we can sort of kick around. And yeah, what are future humans going to think? What are they going to do? How are they going to feel? All these things that we can't possibly know.
Another thing about being a classicist, I know we're over time, but you think about deep time. You know, I reflect often on millennia, and I can't begin to imagine what the world will be like 2 millennia from now. I can't begin to imagine. And, you know, I'm sitting here reading Horace. Actually, I'm reading Horace with students this semester. He died at age 56. And here we are still reading him 2,000 years. I just turned 56. I don't think people are going to be reading me in 2,000 years. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't
know. You don't know that. They could pick up your book in 2,000 years and say, this is a fantastic book.
Well, in contrast to Ozymandias, Horace ends his odes with, I have built a monument more lasting than bronze and higher than the settings of the pyramids. Actually, maybe, yeah, well, the pyramids are still with us. A lot of ancient bronze has been melted down. He may be right.
He could be. Well, I'd like to. Well, I won't be alive to see it, but I hope future generations can, you know, look back at the writings that we have from the past and say, actually, they were right, or something to that effect. I don't know. Is there a classicist version of Eureka? Because I feel like Eureka is way too scientific when you figure something out really cool. Like, I feel like classicists need a cool word that's not Eureka.
Eureka is a very beautiful story of Eureka, right? It was Archimedes in the bathtub and he discovered displacement. And Eureka is ancient Greek, right? Heureka, I have found it, right? So Eureka is classics. So my theory is if you want to live forever, if you want to be immortal, carve your name on a stone. That's a proven technology. Could be a headstone if you die. I love little Roman grave altars. I think they're fantastic. So make a little portrait of yourself on the stone as well. But I bet if we're here in 2,000 years, there will be a lot of information about people derived from their gravestones, because that's really durable material. It's going to stick around.
Well, they'll definitely last longer than people's iPhones, because all those things have to do is die. The battery needs to just go kaput, and then you cannot access any of the stuff that you could carve on a stone. And well, that should be there, unless I suppose the stone is like blown to smithereens somehow. But we're going to hope that they survive.
Metals are so good because they can corrode, or somebody will melt them down for some other purpose. Once you've carved a stone, nobody else is going to mess with it. They're not going to reuse it. It's easier to just get a new stone, right? So that's what I'd say. Go for the stone, like Ozymandias. He had something going.
He was onto the right idea. Yeah, I will say. And if anyone wants to disagree, then send us why you disagree. So I kind of lied. There's actually one more question I'm going to ask you, and that is, how can people, or where can people find you if they want to email you or ask you questions or follow your work?
I have an email address. If you go to my web page, I'm very easy to find at Johns Hopkins in the Classics Department, and my email is there. There's some contact information. There's a phone number that comes to my office that I don't think that phone has actually rung in about 5 years. I'm not even sure I know the number anymore. It used to be people made, like, they would call you in your office, and that never happens anymore. But I would say people are free to email me. I mean, many people have an academia.edu account. I have to say, in all discretion, the whole academia.edu kind of interface and website and the way they're pushing their products kind of drives me bonkers. So I have some papers posted just within Hopkins. And if you visit my website, I have some academic papers up there if people are interested in them. But they're even more boring. So
that's fine. You know what? We will do our best to link some of this contact stuff in your show notes. So if people want to email you questions, or maybe, you know, talk about what they want to study, then they will be able to do that. So we will make sure everything is there. And I want to thank you one more time for joining me. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you today.
Likewise. And thanks for letting me interview you at the beginning. Actually, again, I always want to hear more about people who are, you know, doing more public facing work with classical information and classical materials. And that just seeing what that world really looks like is very helpful to me. So thank you for that.
Glad I was able to help. Yeah. It's been fun, and I hope to have you back on the podcast in the future. I don't know what for yet, but we'll find something.
All right. There's an awful lot of good classicists out there to interview. You've probably barely scratched the surface.
Trireme Transit is now departing Ancient Office Hours. Next stop is Present Ponderings.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.